Next case for argument, Casey versus Quick Trip. Mr. Reinhardt.
Good morning. This case involves a hard-working, dedicated employee of Quick Trip who performed her job in an exemplary manner for 2.5 years. Her excellent performance was recognized by Quick Trip in 3 annual performance reviews. Her excellent performance was rewarded by Quick Trip by annual pay increases and promotions. During the entire tenure of her employment, Rhonda Casey had 2 physical impairments: bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome, which means carpal tunnel syndrome in both hands, as well as Raynaud's phenomenon.
Raynaud's.
Unfortunately, in December of 2000, the management at Quick Trip decided that they did not want to deal with an individual with impairments any longer and terminated Ms. Casey for pretextual reasons. The background and context, Your Honors, is that when Rhonda Casey began working for Quick Trip in June of 98, she had these physical impairments, and she in fact had to quit her historical occupation and job as a waitress and cook because of the carpal tunnel syndrome. She made a full disclosure to Quick Trip and of her impairments, and Quick Trip understood the impairments and accommodated them. They were minor accommodations with lifting, reaching, breaks from the till, and exposure to cold. And the record, I believe, indicates she could perform all of the essential functions of her position, as is indicated in her performance reviews, which state that she met or exceeded expectations in completing all duties required by the shift. That's right in one of her performance evaluations, as is the fact that she did the job for 2.5 years. Throughout Ms. Casey's employment with Quick Trip, she kept Quick Trip completely updated regarding her medical restrictions, and they had a voluminous medical file on her. There was no surprise or secret with respect to her impairments. Unfortunately, there was a management change with respect to a store manager and district supervisor in late 99 or early 2000. The store manager was Dwayne Meyer, the district supervisor was Terry Hanley. They are the decision makers at issue in this case. Ms. Casey indicated to Mr. Meyer on numerous occasions that she had this impairment, and his response is in the record, her responses, which were, "You best do what you're told if you want to keep your job. Do your job and quit being a baby." And when she wore...
What in her medical records demonstrate that it substantially limits her major life activity?
Well,
can't perform a major life activity.
There's 2 major life activities, Your Honor, that are at issue. One is the major life activity of working. Second is...
I don't understand how working can be a life activity. It seems to me, you might as well, by that, say leisure is a life activity. Work can be impeded if you have a disability, that's obvious, but I don't see how working itself is an activity.
Well, what I can say...
The heterogeneity of jobs, so...
What I can say, Your Honor, is that this court has...
What would be a person who couldn't work, even though he or she didn't have no other major life activity had been impaired? Can you think of such a case?
A person who couldn't work even though no other major life activity had been impaired? Probably not, Your Honor.
Then treating work as a life activity is redundant.
It may be, but it's been recognized by this court.
Well, it doesn't make any sense if it's redundant. It's just parasitic on some, tangible life activity, as you admit.
What case in this court holds differently than yours? What case in this court holds that work activity is a life?
I don't know that there's a specific holding, but for instance, in the EEOC versus Rockwell case, this court told a plaintiff what he or she needs to do in order to establish that he or she is substantially limited in the major life activity of working. That is the case that set out, here's the vocational evidence that's required. And in fact, the court said you can't rely upon physician's restrictions. You need vocational evidence. And it gave kind of a bright line test of what needs to be established, which we did submit in the form of an affidavit from a vocational consultant. I can see the Supreme Court has not expressly ruled on the issue, but this court has reviewed...
It doesn't make any sense. It's just superfluous.
Well, it is in the EEOC regulations, Your Honor.
Well, it still doesn't make any sense. Maybe you can explain that why it does make sense, but you haven't.
In any event, the court's decision in this case on summary judgment was that Ms. Casey was not substantially limited the major life activity of work because she could perform the job that was in question. And I'd like to focus on that issue for a second.
Well, she can perform a lot of jobs. I mean, just being unable to perform a specific job obviously doesn't satisfy the statute.
Absolutely not. And that's why the court talks about presenting quantitative and qualitative evidence of how the local job market in which the plaintiff is living is affected. And
well, I don't understand that either, because that would make major life activity depend on where you happen to live and what the job picture is in that area.
I don't profess to understand it, Your Honor. What I can say is...
Well, if you don't understand it, it's hard for you to make a very persuasive argument.
Well, I can tell you what the EEOC says, and I can tell you what this court has.
Well, what if she moved to an area where the only job there is a lifeguard? And she couldn't do that.
That's true.
Would that mean... So what would you do with that case?
Well, you certainly can argue a slippery slope that you could get in a job market where there's only one job, and therefore she is substantially limited. And there are always those extremes, but this case doesn't involve such an extreme, Your Honor. It involves a situation where there was a large job market, and the vocational consultant was able to look at between 600 and 700 jobs and concluded that of all those jobs, she was only able to perform 6%, and if you look at comparable people...
But we probably can't perform 6% of the jobs that are... on offer in Chicago.
Well, that may be there
ourselves. I mean,
but that's probably
6% of all the jobs in Chicago, at least. Go ahead.
But that is probably not because of a disability. I mean, this particular individual had a limited skill set. She was basically an untrained.
Has she been working full time as a cashier since then?
Has she?
Yeah.
She has with accommodations.
Well, she's been working full time.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What manual task does her impairments restrict her ability to perform?
Well, in general,
she can't lift 200-pound boxes, obviously.
In general, she has difficulty gripping, holding on to things. That's reflected in her position's restrictions.
She can hold on to cash if she's acting as a cashier.
She can. She has difficulty reaching. She has difficulty lifting. And specifically, there are a number of tasks, as easy as writing, driving.
But there's an awful lot of other jobs that she can get, though. So how does that fit within the ADA limits?
Well, the question is she significantly restricted? Are there jobs she can get? Yes. I don't believe the ADA says you have to be unable to work to be qualified as disabled. It says, is there a significant restriction on the jobs that this person can perform as compared to an average person having comparable training, skills, and experience? And that's what the vocational testimony and evidence indicates, that 10%, she's precluded from 90% of the available jobs for somebody with her skill set because of her disability. But I also would like to focus on the regarded as section, which deals with myths, stereotypes, and perceptions, and an employer's attitude towards a particular employee. And I would submit to the court that Ms. Casey's situation falls within the regarded as subset of...
Well, what if the person were disfigured, not disabled, just disfigured, and the employer said, well, I'm not going to employ you because my customers don't like looking at a disfigured person? Would that be a violation of the statute?
It would relate to whether or not the employer believed that the impairment, the disfigurement, substantially...
Well, the employer just thinks, you know, the customers don't like this, the way this person looks.
In my opinion, Your Honor, yes, under the substantial life activity of working, which the court has...
Well, that's very strange. What if a person just is homely, just is fat or something, or...
Well, that clearly would not be, because that's not an impairment as defined
by... Well, disfigurement, a scar, does not interfere with a major life activity, does it, or does it?
Well, extreme disfigurement certainly could interfere with your ability to get a job.
What if it's just a scar?
Well, those are the balancing tests and factual issues that courts have to look at, and that I contend should be submitted to a jury.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Reinhart. Mr. Thompson?
Your Honors, make no mistake about it, the appellee in this case is urging this court to rule that working is not a major life activity under the Americans with Disabilities Act. In response to a question that you asked Mr. Reinhart, I think that this court has on several occasions stated that working is a major life activity, but not as a holding per se. I don't believe that in any of those cases, just like in the Supreme Court cases, which have talked about the issue of whether working is a major life activity, did the litigants actually seriously pursue that issue, and was it a contested issue that the court was making a ruling or holding on? I think that this court has assumed, without deciding in contested litigation, that it is, or assumed, just as Sutton has, that it is, and then ruled differently on other grounds and on other issues. But it does seem to the appellee in this case that this court should take this opportunity, since it was argued below, since it is a reason for affirmance, and since it really is the first issue one logically gets to rule that working is not a major life activity under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And for the reasons that we've stated in our brief. And beyond that, Your Honors, it does seem to me that the other issue that has not been significantly litigated in the Seventh Circuit is this issue of how do we apply Sutton to the analysis of the major life activity of working, even if we assume that working is a major life activity. Mr. Reinhart's expert says that Ms. Casey could only do 6% of the jobs, but here we have a woman who was working full-time before, during, and after the alleged employment decision. In Sutton, the court clearly says that what we should be looking at is the present indicative tense. That is to say, is there some impairment that substantially limits a major life activity? And it seems to me to be impossible to argue that somebody who is working at the moment of the alleged adverse employment action, that person is somehow in the present indicative tense, substantially limited in the major life activity of working. It is the criticism that Sutton makes that one ought not to look at these hypothetical possible issues, that it's the same reason that the Seventh Circuit ought to reject the analysis of this particular expert, and in fact, utilize a more robust interpretation of Sutton when it's looking at these experts. Because the problem with this expert is the expert is sort of going back in time 2 years and saying, well, hypothetically, there was 6% of the jobs that she could have gotten that she was medically qualified to do. That ought not to be the analysis. The analysis, as the Supreme Court has said, is at the time of the alleged employment decision, was she substantially limited? Was there any job that she held in which she was substantially limited in the major life activity of working? No, she was working. Is there any job that she desired in which she was substantially limited? Not that we know of. There's nothing in the record that suggests a single job that she wanted that she couldn't get. It's also clear from the admissions of the plaintiff in this case that she was not substantially limited in either of the major life activities that are at issue, manual tasks or the life activity of working. She admitted that she was very healthy. She admitted that she was consistently employed. She admitted in her brief that she was able to perform her job with minor assistance from coworkers. If she can perform her job except with minor assistance from coworkers, it doesn't seem to me that she's substantially limited either in the major life activity of working or in the major life activity of manual tasks, at least as regards to those manual tasks being performed at work. She got, as Mr. Reinhart said, 3 good performance reviews with 3 increases. That hardly seems to suggest that she's substantially impaired in her ability to work. And again, an application of Sutton suggests that this plaintiff, from her own personal experience and her own personal mitigating measures, as the United States Supreme Court has argued that we ought to look at, she has mitigated whatever problems that she had. She found ways around the problems that she allegedly had. She used 2 hands. She took a little longer time. She had somebody assist her. All of the things that she does in her normal life, she could do with some mitigating assistance, with the exception of, as noted in the brief, knitting, crocheting, sewing, and braiding hair. And I think that as a matter of law, this court can rule that those are not of central importance to most people's daily lives, which is what Toyota requires. Regarded as issue point, I guess, is I think most obviously refuted by an examination of what the plaintiff's primary allegation in this case has been. The plaintiff's primary allegation of discrimination is that we took a look at these restrictions and ignored them. We said, poo-poo on those restrictions, you go ahead and do your job. Despite the fact that you're giving us these restrictions, we don't think that they should prevent you from doing anything. And now, the plaintiff is trying to argue, and the appellant is trying to argue, that what we were really doing was regarding her as disabled. In fact, by her own admission, we were doing the opposite. We, according to the plaintiff and the appellate, we were basically concluding that her restrictions were fake or illegitimate or exaggerated. And so we ignored them. And that was our failure to accommodate. Seems hard to argue on the one hand that we failed to accommodate all these restrictions, and then on the other hand to argue that we regarded her as being disabled.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Reinhart, how much time does he have? No more time. Your time expired. Sorry. Okay.